Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls. In the West, in Europe and the United States, there are many people who see the veil as worn by Muslim women as an instrument of repression. However, our guest for this hour of the show says that viewing the veil that way is both simplistic and misplaced. While indeed some people might see the veil as a way of controlling women, others see it differently. Some see it as a sign of modesty, and there are still others who see it as something that is actually and frankly erotic and romantic. She says that the many meanings of the veil and the emotions that it arouses testify to its continuing significance in the modern world. Our guest in this hour is Fagha Shirazi. She is associate professor in Middle Eastern languages and cultures at the College of Liberal Arts at University of Texas in Austin. She's particularly interested in the way people think about and talk about gender in Muslim societies, and a main focus of her research is the hijab, the Islamic veil. She's the author of a book that was published a couple of years back that explores this, and if you're interested in reading on the subject, you can look for the book. It's titled The Veil Unveiled, The Hijab in Modern Culture. The book was published in 2001 by the University Press of Florida, and I'm sure should still be available if you would like to take a look at it. As we talk here this morning, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers, and at any point here, questions, comments are welcome. The only thing we ask of people who are listening and want to call in is just they try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving, get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, questions certainly are welcome. Professor Shirazi, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maybe just as a very general kind of question to start with, and I'm sure we can talk about a lot of different things, but it seems that there is a growing controversy surrounding the wearing of the veil by Muslim women. And here we must acknowledge that we're talking about not one kind of garment, but several, everything from a head covering to something that covers everything. And that the controversy seems particularly to be getting intense in Europe and in Britain, in the UK. I think we've seen some of that in the United States, perhaps not a lot yet, but maybe we shouldn't be surprised if we see more. Why do you think it is that the wearing of the veil is something that has generated so much heated debate?
Most of the people associate veiling with the tradition of Islam. And it actually is one of the most outwardly signs of if a person is wearing veil, definitely she is a Muslim. So this association is actually makes the person more visible in the public as a Muslim. And I guess because of the recent events of September 11th and what had happened in Madrid, Spain, and also in England, it has become more noticeable. It's not that just Muslim women in the West have been veiling themselves, you know, recently. As long as they have arrived and they were veiled, they continue doing that. But in my opinion, the notion of the association of the person with the religion is really made it more noticeable in the recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And the form of the veiling that the woman had started to adopt, for example, as you mentioned, there are many different styles. Some are really more above and beyond the requirement, and that might be a personal choice. But as I have mentioned it in my book, there's so many different forms of versatility. It's just the semantic versatility and the meaning in this piece of cloth, just small piece of cloth, had generated so many different meanings all the way from religious protests, feminism, and whatnot, you know, politics, that one cannot be really sure why a woman veiled or re-veiled herself for what kind of a personal reason or what kind of an agenda.
So it sounds as if you're saying that perhaps if there is controversy about women veiling themselves, that it is at least in part due to the fact that it is a very visible symbol that there are Muslims living among us, and for people who are not Muslim, that makes them nervous.
That's correct. That's correct. It's because it's just very, very visible sign. I mean, obviously, when there are a lot of Muslim men also, but you don't see them all wearing turbans or, you know, any kind of a, in comparison to the women who are, in their opinion or the personal choices, following, you know, the strict religious requirement of certain kind of coverage. You don't see the men, Muslim men, you know, in that, in the same role. So women have become more visible.
And I think that, that perhaps also in Western societies, in Europe, in the UK, in the United States, we may have an imperfect commitment to the idea of freedom and personal choice, but it is something that we like to believe in. And somehow I think that people who are not Muslim have a hard time believing that or accepting the fact that a woman might wear the veil as a matter of free choice, that somehow we have this idea that it's something that is forced upon women.
It is a very wrong notion, because in the Muslim feminism, they actually believe on the reverse side of it, that, how can I explain this much better? If a woman, obviously there are governments and repressed governments that, you know, they do that to women. If we talk about the some of the governments that impose the veil, of course that's become a sign of repression. But even within those systems, women find their own way to display their individuality, and they resist through their choice of certain kind of veils. They resist and they protest that repression. They still are veiled, but they are not veiled in accordance to what the government wants to see them. So they fight it. However, in the discussion of this Muslim feminist ideology, there are a lot of Muslim feminists that truly believe that the veiling themselves had emancipated them, because they're not subjugated to the sexual identity. And if they are treated or they are dealt with, they are treated and dealt with according to their intelligence and what they have to offer. And that puts aside their sexuality. So emancipation in, you know, you can look at it from many different perspectives. Mm-hmm. One is emancipated by removing layers of clothes, and another group might be emancipated by choice, covering themselves. So you will run to these kind of discussions in the feminist discourse.
I think it's interesting you suggesting that there are those two seemingly disparate ideas of assertion of individuality, of freedom, of control of self, one that you would cover, the other that you would uncover, and that in a sense the meaning could be the same of those two things.
Exactly.
And I think it's interesting because you, in one of the things in the book that you look at is images of the veil and of veiled women in Western popular culture, in advertising and elsewhere, that are highly sexualized, that this is an erotic kind of symbol. That's sort of what we have been told. And that a couple of things that makes me think is that that the presence of that image is more common than we perhaps would think, and that we don't think about it very much, but that it is a highly eroticized kind of image.
That's exactly what those Muslim feminists try to avoid. Mm-hmm. They try to avoid the idea of displaying their body for sales of goods and products is really unnecessary. It's the whole idea of veiling had really collected a different kinds of a notion in the Western society, and that's normally in academia we put the blame on Orientalist writings and the travel logs and travelers that came in contact for the first time, and they were fascinated by discovered women. And they kind of fantasized a lot of things, which in academia we really believe that most of it is generated by the imagination. But it is due to the fact, if you look around and you really pay attention, you will see that even feminist Western women opposed to sexualizing, female body for any reason, and using the body for commercials and sales of sexy cheese or maybe very normal products. Mm-hmm. Even the Western feminists are opposed to that. But what most of people don't see, as much as you get used to see these commercials, you don't really pay attention to it in that respect. Am I correct? If you see, if you open a magazine and you see so many commercials with women's ads and, half-naked women selling products or advertising, just because we have been bombarded by these images, it's become kind of a ordinary, everyday type of commercials that we run to and we see. But for the people who see anything out of ordinary, and out of ordinary in that respect means veiled woman, they become noticeable because it's out of ordinary. So in sales and commercials, in my book, I did mention also about the advertisements that are using the veiled images of women, not only in the Western media, but it's also in the indigenous Muslim lands, like, for example, Saudi. They also themselves had fantasized some of the same notions of the mystique about the veils and, the Orientalist ideology, but in a different way, which is more appropriate to their own culture.
Can you give an example?
Yes. The examples would be that in the magazines, which is a feminine, women's magazines called Sayyidati, very classy and so forth, with articles and commercials and advertisements. If you look at those, there are a lot of expensive products, which are Western products, like Swiss watches and Concord Swiss watch brand and so forth. I followed that Concord watch advertisement for maybe 3-4 years. And in that book, I have examples that how the Saudi chooses to use the veiled woman, the image of the veiled woman, very mystique and very Orientalist style. That is, she's not exposed, but she's like a dreamlike and putting a very beautiful text in Arabic, which is, by the way, gender of the watch in Arabic is feminine. So it really worked really good. So making a kind of ambiguous reference to the watch or the woman, because they are both of female gender, And in the background, you will see a noble Bedouin man riding a horse, and, you know, and on the bottom, you see that the precious watch with really exuberant prices, like $50,000. It's not a watch anymore. It's a piece of jewelry. But they advertise it that way because it's appealing to the history of the Bedouin life and the history of the Saudi woman, but they see it in a different concept because they have a history with it. They can understand that. The story of the noblemen and the Bedouin tribes, as you see that, they have a connection with it. It will work for them because they will understand it. But that is from a different perspective. I think it makes it very different when it is looked upon as an illicit sexual concept versus coming from a love affair and a tradition. I don't know if I make myself clear.
I think, yeah, that's interesting. And yet at the same time, I'm looking at these three ads, and in particular, in three of them, there is a woman appears, and she is in the almost most complete form of the veil. Her head is covered, her hair is covered, her bottom of her face. All you can see are her eyes, and she's definitely giving you that come hither sort of a look, and it's very mysterious, it's very erotic.
Exactly.
It's very, but it strikes me that it's still, even in this way, with the woman as much covered as she is, the ads is still using female sexuality to pitch the product.
Exactly, and that was the point. It is, we're not only blaming, you know, the West for doing that. What my point was, the Muslims themselves do that. But in a different way.
Hmm.
They don't have to make the... I have some ads, but then unfortunately could not afford to pay for them to put them in the book because they were too expensive. But, for example, I had some ads from a Western media that the woman is in string bikini, but then she's covering her face.
Hmm.
So that was like a mocking the religion. And it would have been very, very effective to show the differences. But obviously, you know, if we pay attention on everyday media and on everyday, journals and magazines, I will guarantee you, you will come across because you're focusing on that. And for the time that I was collecting ads and I was doing this this book, I probably was so cute to the idea of looking for materials like that everywhere I started seeing them. Probably I wouldn't have paid attention before,
mm-hmm.
but because I was really cute on that, and I started seeing so many different commercials that I never noted them before. I guess if you start looking for them, you will see it.
You will start to see them. Yeah, I'm sure that's correct. All right, let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Faga Shirazi. She is an associate professor in Middle Eastern Languages and Cultures in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. And she's particularly interested in how people think about, talk about gender in Muslim societies. And a main focus of her research is the Islamic veil. She is the author of a book, which was published in 2001, that explores this. The title of her book is The Veil Unveiled, The Hijab and Modern Culture. This was published by the University Press of Florida. And questions are certainly welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you write about in the book that I think is also very interesting, in as much as we tend to make this association between veiling and Islam, that in fact the practice of veiling women predates Islam. It is something that comes that you can find actually in many cultures, and certainly was not something that Islam invented.
That's correct. Islam did not invent actually veiling, and in the book I have documented way back to 600 BC, and that can tell you a lot. The very first documented case was in the law of Hammurabi, in which during that time a free woman and a noble woman would be untouchable, and in the public she should be veiled. And that was a sign of she's a noble, she's untouchable. And if the slaves and the prostitutes in the public, they had no rights to veil themselves because that would put them in a different class. Mm-hmm. And the very first documented on the veil was about the story of a prostitute who had taken the noble woman's coverage, and then she had covered herself in the public, and she was discovered, and she was brought to the court, and she was punished. So as you can see that, the veil, the origin of the veil, had association with respect and dignity and the status of woman. It was not really anything to do with the oppressions or, you know, making her less than the rest of the society. So the tradition of veiling existed during the time of pre-Islamic era. And Arabs were not the only one, at least the Bedouin Arabs were not the only one who used to cover themselves publicly. Sasanian Empire, which is before Islam, and there were the Persian Empire. The Sasanian women also had the same status, and they were noble women in the court and outside. Anyone who was a noble and he was not a slave, she would be veiled, because that would be the public sign of this woman is untouchable. So the veil had a very distinct association with the noble and a status. Mm-hmm. And in the recent history, for example, when you are looking at the women in Punjab area in India, in northern part of India, that there are Muslims and there are non-Muslims, one of the very first signs that the Punjabi woman who works in the field will do, because if you work in the fields, you cannot afford to be veiled because it's kind of hindrance to your movement. But if the husband becomes more affluent and the husband can afford to ask the wife not to work out anymore in the fields, the very first thing they will do is they will veil themselves. For them, this is a sign of upward mobility. That means now my husband can afford to keep me at home so I don't have to do labor work. So here is my status. I can afford to put the veil on without being able to, you know, I mean, that means I'm not working in the fields. So as you can see that, it the meaning of it is really different. And it could be used so many different ways.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, too, it would be worth pointing out that within Islam, there are, in some places women wear veils and some places they don't. And there is, as you said, that there's some difference in the style and how it is one, what one wears and how it is worn and what options there are. And that perhaps it's worth mentioning that there is some, I don't know if controversy is the word, debate perhaps, about what exactly Scripture says and whether what we're talking about is that women are required to cover themselves, or what we're really talking about is that a certain way of dressing that's related to your general comportment it's this injunction for modesty that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to cover yourself completely, but it seems very much a matter of how it is you're going to read that, and then how you're going to put that into practice, and then also perhaps you layer on top of that cultural beliefs about women, and that it's very difficult to sort out what comes from the religion and what comes from culture, and that at least that's one reason why you'd see big differences from one place to another.
That's correct, because everything is open to interpretation. And the way that is interpreted, because it's ambiguous, the verse is very ambiguous. It make a reference to, there are two different direct references about the coverage. One is addressing the wife of the prophet that, draw the veil upon your bosom and hide your jewels. Well, for a textual interpretation, if you just read it straight from the text, okay, cover your bosom and hide your jewels. Okay, it didn't even say cover your head. It didn't even say cover your face and hide your jewels. Is this jewel the jewel of chastity? Is this jewel is where I wear my jewelry? As you understand that, this could be interpreted so many different ways. Of course, the clerics will read this verse in a more generic way, not picking up on the words and words. And then they interpret that. And there are many different ways to interpret that, even among the clerks. Most of them agree that it is making a reference to covering the woman's hair. Although we don't see even a word reference to hair, or even talking about a different, a specific type of the veil. But it is understood, according to the religious interpretation, that a woman, first of all, should be covered decently, and then majority of the clerks are in agreement that her head should be covered. Okay, now, within this interpretation, you can come to endless styles and forms. What I have done in my study, I have looked at the vocabulary in certain kinds of cultures, because the Islamic term for the coverage of the women in a way that means decent coverage for the hair and body is hijab, means to hide. Mm-hmm. But I have looked at many other languages like Persian, Urdu, and I looked at the Tajiki and many others, trying to find out in their own culture, did they have a word which is equal to hijab? And I did find so many, yes. That means this was not brought by Islam. The tradition of coverage of the women already existed. Otherwise, why would they have the vocabulary for it? And this style of wearing that I think they particularly now that is debated in Holland about banning the niqab. And niqab is not hijab. Niqab is a reference to a form of hijab which is completely covering the face as well. So this is not anywhere in Quran, and as a matter of fact, many of the highest authority of the religions, they do not agree on that either, because it is not part of a woman's coverage for a Muslim woman. However, I have a document that I looked at. The highest authority in the the Sunni tradition of Islam from Al-Azhar in University of Al-Azhar in Cairo. He specifically talks about this issue. He says that to cover the face and the hands are not part of the Quranic injunctions. However, if a woman wants to do that, we have no objections. But at the same time, to ostracize the or to go around and try to preach to the other woman to say that she is not in a good hijab because her face is not covered is a sin. So if you even understand that from the religious authority, covering the face was never part of this injunction, this Quranic injunction. It is something that if she wants to do it, that's fine, but it's not required. So, as you understand, recently, even in the University of Cairo, for the reason of security, the president of University of Cairo banned women to enter female dormitories with niqab, which is this face covered, because you don't know who's hiding behind it. He said that he has no problem if the woman wants to wear niqab going to the classroom, walks the grounds of the campus, but I will forbid them to enter female dormitories when they are hidden behind the niqab, because I want safety and protection for all the residents. So I can understand that this might be an issue of security. But then at the same time, when in liberal countries, which you don't have a dress code as such or enforcement of certain kinds of dress that it has to be imposed, the person who's also wearing hijab or niqab will feel very affected. It's just discriminated because she might feel like they have the right to wear anything they want. Why can't I have the right to wear it? So it's a controversial, you know, question.
Well, we have a couple of callers here. I wanted to bring them into our conversation and do that first. We'll go to Champaign County. Someone here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. I have too many things as usual, but I just recall hearing someone on a local community station reading what was purportedly the Quran, but maybe it was a commentary, and it went through a list of, this was a convert to Islam who was reading it, American woman, saying that it sort of went through a list of who could see the face of the woman, and it went through the relatives and this whole list, and I don't know if that was a commentary to the Quran or not the Quran. Do you know anything that does that kind of specification?
It's not a reference to the face. It's a reference that coming in front of the people who are not related to you without the hijab. Hijab is not the niqab. Niqab is the face coverage.
So the hair coverage is what it specifies.
Yeah, the hair coverage. Mm. Is the hijab. And that's true.
And
anyone
so,
with whom you have a potential to have sexual relationship, like those who are not related to you immediately, you have to cover yourself from them.
Okay, so it was because they were related, they were seen as not... Okay. Well,
for example, you don't cover yourself in front of your father or your father-in-law. Or your brother, or your own sons, because those are your kins and relatives. But you have to cover, Muslims can marry first cousins. But if you have a male cousin, you have a male cousin who's at the age that, you know, adult, you have to cover in front of him, but not your uncle, because your uncle is like your own father.
Now, that is a surah, though. That is directly from the Quran or not?
Yes, it is.
Okay. I had another question. You mentioned the story about the, I guess, what one would call a temple prostitute. There was a book written in Turkey recently that said that the hair covering, I believe, was related to a pre-Islamic thing and went into this history. And I'm wondering whether that was the same reference you were having, or is that unrelated?
Oh, it's probably unrelated, but I won't be surprised that it was a culture. It was a culture from that part of the world that, you know, coverage means untouchable. It means this woman is taken. She's either married or she is from a noble family or she's not a prostitute. But anything else was open to public. And this is what of the one of the arguments that most of the Muslim feminists who are using, if I'm open, that means I'm open to invasion, you know, some kind of a, I'm not covered, so I'm available. This is one of the arguments that they use. But the references you're talking about, I'm not familiar with.
Right, because it isn't the way you characterized it. It's sort of the opposite, actually. It was.
Uh-huh.
But I have a further issue, and that's the idea of how things get appropriated to be seen as part of the religion when they came from other sources. Now, I'm thinking of another very controversial issue, which is female genital mutilation. And I understand from an Ethiopian friend that in the countryside, even Christian tribes practice this. So it's not associated with Islam at all, no, fundamentally, but it is jealously practiced in some areas still, and it's performed by the women, the elder women.
That's true.
So I don't know what you have to say about any of that, but it just seems to me it's so amazing that people can develop an attachment to a practice, whether it's as drastic as what I was referring to, or as maybe as perhaps insignificant in some ways as a hairpiece, but associating it so fundamentally with their faith when it's fairly demonstrable that it isn't the case. And I guess there's someone else waiting, so I'll listen on the radio.
No?
Yeah, this is very interesting because female genital mutilation has nothing to do with Islam. And as a matter of fact, if you look at the countries that they do that, 99% of them fall in Africa. It's a tradition. It was a tradition, and it still is a tradition with some of the cultures in Africa. And I guess after they converted to Islam, they kept the tradition. There is nothing like that in Quran. However, some of the scholars that say that in some of the interpretations of the traditions of the Prophet, there are few references to it. The female genital mutilation, as the caller already mentioned it, is not only practiced by the Muslims, it's practiced by many other religions who happen to be in the countries or in the cultures that they do this form of cultural ritual. It is very interesting that to be a virgin, it may not be enough to have honor, but to be a virgin and also an available or the procedure is very horrible, and they have three different levels of surgical things that they do. But she will be closed down. She will be sewed down. So the whole idea is if you are in a culture that it requires that in order to get married, what are the choices? What is the choice? Either you want to be the one, a sore thumb, that you don't want to do this, or you have to abide. The unfortunate part of it is women themselves are guilty of this. If the woman stopped doing that, probably this horrible practice will stop. I have studies that anthropologists had interviewed the men from some of these cultures, because the whole old notion and idea was, oh, this is for the pleasure of men. That's why the men want the woman to be, you know, sewn down and also mutilated so they will have the sexual pleasure. But it was amazing that the men themselves said that. This is horrible because, first of all, there is no pleasure in that. To see a woman goes through agony to have intercourse is not pleasurable. Second thing is, it's very hard on them because sometimes it takes over a year to really consummate the marriage because of the pain that she has to go through. So it is not really the men's problem for some of these cultures. It is the tradition which has nothing to do with the religion, but the religion always gets defeated by the culture. And that is true for so many different Muslim cultures, Christian cultures, or whatnot. One of the best examples I give to my students is we have one God, Allah, one prophet, Muhammad, and one Quran, the scripture. Why is it that Islamic law is so different? Why is it Islamic law that is practiced in Saudi Arabia is so different from Islamic Republic of Iran, from Pakistan, from North Africa? Why is it? Because every one of those cultures incorporated what was the tradition within their own culture, and they reinterpreted the way that they wanted to, you know, read the Quran or read the traditions of the prophet. It's the same thing. It doesn't matter if she is a Jew or she is a Christian or she is a Muslim. If she happens to be living in Sudan and this is the culture, she will be mutilated. And this is very unfortunate. Unless the governments put the foot in the front and stop this tradition, which I think Egypt has started to do that. At least Egypt, what they have done is this tradition was practiced by women who were not certified and they would cause death for the patients. It is illegal in Egypt for anyone without a government's training or license to practice any of these incisions. So maybe that way at least some of the lives are saved because they don't die from excess bleeding and infection.
We have about 5-6 minutes left, and one more caller I'd like to try to get in, and perhaps also for people who've been listening for a while here, I should introduce our guest, Faga Shirazi. She is Associate Professor in Middle Eastern Languages and Cultures in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas, Austin. She's interested particularly in how people in Muslim societies think about, talk about gender, and a main focus of her research is the Islamic veil, hijab, and she's written a book about it. It was published in 2001. It's titled The Veil Unveiled, the Hijab in Modern Culture, and it is published by the University Press of Florida. We have another caller here I want to try to get in Charleston, line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I have 3 points I want to make quickly. Perhaps, you know, there is no religion that can be practiced outside of culture. That's just a comment. And then my understanding is the word for female genital mutilation in Egypt is sunnah, which means tradition. So that's part of the reason that it gets so confused with Islamic tradition, because the name is tradition, and it's the name, it's an Islamic type of association, sunnah. But the main point I wanted to ask about was, are there any progressive or Muslim women who are saying, why should we stick with this rankism, that wearing the hijab is a kind of rankism? It's saying you're not a slave and you're not a prostitute, although prostitutes were traditionally concubines or slaves themselves. So it's kind of saying, yes, I'm superior. But is that necessarily seen by all women as a good thing to say? I mean, it's gone from being like a class superiority to saying, well, I'm somehow more pious than other people because I'm wearing this hijab?
About your first question about the sunnah,
mm-hmm.
You are correct, because that's an Arabic word and just means tradition.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe not necessarily tradition of the prophet.
Right, exactly.
So that's the difference.
Uh-huh.
And with your second questions about that, if some woman would say that I shouldn't be wearing this because I don't want to say that, you know, and we know that you're not a prostitute and so forth and all that, there are so many different explanations for that. It depends on whom you're asking and the reasons that they are putting that.
Uh-huh.
So you will never find a unified answer among, let me just give you an example, a very simple example. During the Islamic Republic Revolution in Iran,
mm-hmm.
when every woman had to be veiled publicly, okay, if you had a household of five females, all at the age that they should have been veiled, okay,
mm-hmm.
you would have found maybe three different reasons among that family members that they were not agreeable on the reason, on one united reason why they have to veil.
Right.
The older woman would have veiled because she has already veiled.
Mm-hmm.
Or this is her style of clothes.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to change, revolution or no revolution. One of them would be veiled herself, revolutionary. That means the posters that they were plastered all over the cities, and the, you know, Khomeini had preached a certain form of veil for the pious woman. Another one, maybe the younger sister, neither wanted to look like mother, nor wanted to look like an older sister who was an Islamic revolutionary person. She had to veil because she had no choice.
Mm-hmm.
So her style of veil would be very different. She would get by with the minimum requirement. So even within the same family, you will have differences in opinions and styles. You can never say, yes, you can find out the woman who never veiled themselves, and at this point, they are veiling themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them agreed on the idea of, I have found my religion, this is a requirement, and I want to be veiled at this point, because
mm-hmm.
I am supposed to be a pious Muslim.
Right.
However, it doesn't mean those who are not veiled, they're non-pious and they're not practicing.
Mm-hmm.
That is very, very difficult to answer, because if you stop five veiled women, three of them might agree and one thing, two may not say this. That some may even say that I had to veil because that's what my husband wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to please him. You know, I mean, who knows?
Uh-huh. So do you think what's going on in Europe is only going to solidify misunderstandings between Muslims and non-Muslims in Europe?
No. I really think, for example, the case in England, I think that is one of the most visible one. I really think that you have to think about it this way. Most of these people that they put the niqab, the mm-hmm. face veil,
mm-hmm.
not the ordinary veil, they don't have problem with that. The problem is with the face veil.
Right.
When you become non-recognizable.
Right.
So you have to understand this way. Most of these people are young. They are born in Britain from immigrant families. Majority of them, their parents even didn't veil. However, there is a lot of discrimination, and we have to be honest about it. There is a lot of racism in Europe. These people who are British, they are caught in the middle. They don't look like a British person. They don't have an indigenous Muslim land that they can say, I'm from Pakistan or Iran or elsewhere. They are Britons. However, they are very, very different in look. And it doesn't matter how hard they try, they will never be accepted. So, in that respect, this is only all my opinion, and I'm not quoting anybody. In that respect, I feel they cannot identify themselves with British culture because they are from an immigrant family with a different culture, although they are British too. So they pick on the most significant symbolism of something which is not British. And they dress themselves in that. It's just like a, many of them may not even want to look like this, but it is like a protest. It is like putting a costume on so you become visible to the whole world that you are this, because I am not accepted. I truly, honestly believe at least this might be one of the reasons.
We're at the point here where we're almost going to have to stop. Maybe, Professor Shirazi, I just ask one further question, again going to this issue of some of the controversy generated by women veiling and deciding to veil in Europe. Do you think that at some point we'd be likely to see some of this, perhaps at least a little bit more controversy around the issue of the veil here in the United States?
Yes, I see that in our campuses, because we have a very humongous campus.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to maybe 10 years ago, we didn't have as many young women covering their head. At this point, I have never seen any niqabi woman. I mean, I have to say that. I have not seen any woman who covers the face. But I walk around the campus. It's an ordinary scene that you see young Muslim women covering their head. But covering their head, wearing a tight jean. So I don't know if it meant to be. The actual idea for covering is to not to attract any gaze to yourself. But then I don't know, the combination they put on, maybe it's a faddish thing to do. If you're wearing a head cover and then you're wearing the tightest jeans, I don't know. I'm still looking at her because she becomes a novelty.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stop and ask them, they will just say that, well, I'm a Muslim and I have to cover my face, I mean my head. If that means that they are really identifying themselves first with the religion, which I have my personal idea. I have a problem with that.
Yeah. We're going to have to stop. We're just at the end of the time. Professor Shirazi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Afagi Shirazi is Associate Professor in Middle Eastern Languages and Cultures, University of Texas at Austin.